Hello, I'm Marlene Saeed. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, the race for green subsidies is accelerating. The EU has set out a plan to boost the production of electric cars and renewable energy projects. But can the bloc keep up with the US and China? Also this week, Brazil's president is loosening the purse strings and he's threatened the central bank's autonomy, demanding lower interest rates. But will Lula da Silva's economic plan work? Plus, Hong Kong is facing its highest rate of homelessness in a decade. We explore how one NGO is helping people sleeping in tunnels or on the streets to find shelter. The International Energy Agency estimates the global market for mass-produced clean energy will triple to around $650 billion a year by the year 2030. Now, the world's biggest economies want a slice of that growing industry. The United States recently announced the Inflation Reduction Act. This includes billions of dollars in grants and loans to boost financing and deployment of new clean energy projects. But it sparked a trade dispute with its allies in Europe. And now the EU has set out its own plan to compete with the US as a production hub for green products. It includes redeploying more than $270 billion remaining from the EU's Pandemic Recovery Fund. The European Commission has also suggested relaxing state aid rules to allow governments to pump cash into green industries. It plans to make approvals for green projects faster and seal trade agreements to secure supplies of critical raw materials. The EU also wants to create a European sovereignty fund to invest in emerging technologies. So why is Europe so threatened by America's Inflation Reduction Act? Well, they fear that the IRA's $369 billion of subsidies for electric vehicles and other clean technologies could put companies based in Europe at a disadvantage. For example, many of the tax breaks are only applicable for products manufactured in North America, which could, of course, encourage European firms to shift production to the US. Well, the plan also provides tax credits to consumers who buy electric cars made in the US, which could again make European-made electric vehicles less attractive to buyers. But even with the biggest ever climate bill, the US lagged behind China's green spending last year. The energy research group Bloomberg NEF says almost half of all global energy transition investments worth $546 billion were in China. The EU says Chinese subsidies have been twice as high as those in the bloc relative to GDP. The EU, as a single entity, came second at $180 billion, while the US spent $141 billion. From Brussels, I'm joined now by Milan Elkebout. Milan is a research fellow and head of the Climate Policy Programme at the Centre for European Policy Studies in Brussels. Thank you for joining the programme. Is the EU right to be threatened by the US's Inflation Reduction Act?
Well, yes and no. On the one hand, the Inflation Reduction Act offers very generous subsidies, and these subsidies are combined with some other measures related to the components that need to be used in the production of certain goods, and these are really a challenge to European industry. But on the other hand, no. Because the Inflation Reduction Act still really is overwhelmingly a good thing. It is the first time that the US passes a comprehensive federal climate policy, which for the first time also targets the greenhouse gas emissions coming from heavy industry. And all these investments that the subsidies promote will lead to increased economies of scale and therefore also lower costs for low carbon technologies. And that is really a good thing for all countries around the world.
Until now, industrial policy in the EU has been restrained by very tough competition laws. In order for them to have their own green tech splurge, Europe is going to have to change that. How tricky is that going to be for them?
This is indeed a very important but difficult issue. What we should keep in mind is that these competition rules, called state aid rules, have been in place for a very long time. It actually goes back to the late 1950s, really the beginning of European integration. But then they have been also a lot more relaxed since the beginning of the pandemic. And the reason why was because due to all the lockdowns, really extensive support to businesses that had to close was necessary anyway. And these relaxed rules are still in place today. Now, there is a risk that if we keep those rules very relaxed, that we get a subsidy raise between the member states. And that's a very bad thing within the European single market. So there definitely is some interest from European policymakers also to make sure that we still have some degree of competition rules between the member states. But of course, they should not be so strict that the countries and the EU as a whole cannot respond to this challenge coming from the US.
Yeah. So what do you make of the EU's green proposals?
It has quite a few components. It's really not just only about subsidy, but also really looks at what are the bottlenecks that exist today that can slow down the rollout of clean technologies. And there are some things beyond subsidies that are very important there. One of those is labor market skills. I mean, the labor markets in a lot of European countries are very tight at the moment. Another very important thing relates to permitting. Renewables in particular are very economically competitive already. Costs have come down enormously. So it's not really a question about money, but you can have all sorts of rules by local authorities or people who would not like to see wind turbines in their neighborhood. And that can slow down the rollout of these technologies as well. So faster permitting is also part of it. That's a good thing. Really, when it comes to the subsidies, Europe has for a long time already supported industry quite extensively. But it has done so in a very different way from the US, because the US, well, is a single country with a single fiscal policy. So it can really provide money very directly. In the EU, it's much more dispersed across different programs. And one of the most difficult things about the European approach is that we have a lot of administrative processes with uncertain outcomes for companies. The strength of the US approach is that companies know exactly how much money they will be able to get out of the Inflation Reduction Act. So one part of the European response is also really about simplifying the rules and making them more transparent and more predictable. And that is a very good thing.
It's interesting that you mentioned that point, that it's not just about spending, because when you look at the numbers, the US is spending almost $370 billion on subsidies. China's subsidies are double that of Europe. So how do you see Europe competing with the US and China when it comes to the green economy?
To start with, maybe if we look at this number of the US, the $370 billion US have been reported very extensively. It's a staggering sum in some way, but it's also for a 10-year period. So as a percentage of the US GDP, it's not that much. And a lot of this money is also for things like renewables or transport emissions reductions, where Europe really has had some very serious and successful policy for the last 10 to 20 years already. So a part of the American money is also for catching up to Europe. Then another 60, 70 billion will really be about industry. And this is where most of the discussion in Europe is about, because the industrial sectors are about traded goods. And this is where competition can really play a role. Europe has also supported industrial innovation quite a bit over the last decade, but it has really focused on the early stage innovation, basically research and development. What the US is doing now is providing direct funding for production and for investment. And that is something that we in Europe do not have yet, and what we need to address in the future, so that there are clear incentives to invest and deploy technologies that are still a bit more expensive.
Finally, how do you see consumers benefiting from all this, from the subsidy race and the investments going on around the world in the green energy front?
I mean, ultimately, over the long term, as we have seen already with renewables such as solar PV or onshore and offshore wind, if you increase the scale of production in a certain technology, in a certain product, then costs tend to come down. It's not a rule that will always apply, but in most cases, if you can increase the scale, then things will become more affordable. And that is a good thing for consumers around the world.
Milan, really interesting to talk to you about the subject. Milan Elkebout from the Centre for European Policy Studies in Brussels. Thank you.
Thank you.
Iraq has revalued its currency as part of an effort to stabilise the foreign exchange market. The cabinet has approved a decision to set the exchange rate at 1,300 dinars per US dollar. Now, the Iraqi dinar had been selling at 1,470 dinars against the greenback before the US introduced tighter controls on transactions by commercial Iraqi banks. Mahmoud Abdulwahid has more from Baghdad.
Prices are going up in Iraqi stores. Since mid-November, the dinar has declined against US dollar, losing about 10% of its value. Abu Ranat says he doubly checks price tags every time he comes to the supermarket.
Shopowners blame it on the dollar exchange rate because most of the products are imported. In this case, the government should pay our salaries in dollars.
Since November, the US has tightened the rules on international transfers to prevent money laundering. It's reduced cash flows to Iraqi banks by about 80%.
It's clear the US Federal Reserve is scrutinizing foreign transfers from Iraq, especially to those countries unfriendly with the US, such as Iran, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen. Consequently, Iraq's daily wire transfers from the US have been cut from $240 million to only $22 million on a day.
The government has launched a campaign to combat illegal currency trading and promised to hold further discussions with Washington to stabilize the exchange rate.
This is one aspect of an economic challenge that requires a brave response and practical solutions to end the wrong financial policies inherited by the current government.
In the meantime, the Prime Minister has extended credit to small businesses by $500 million.
Despite government promises to contain the depreciation, many Iraqis are worried about an increase in prices ahead of the holy month of Ramadan, especially in imports such as gas and wheat.
A number of currency exchanges have stopped trading until there is more certainty about rates. Some Iraqis blame the central bank for the shortage of dollars. Others accuse the United States of weaponizing the dollar. Either way, it's the Iraqi people who bear the brunt of the changes.
Brazil is the world's largest exporter of beef and the second largest exporter of grain. Yet tens of millions of Brazilians are not getting enough to eat. The nation's president made it clear that his government's priority is reducing the number of hungry people. Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has boosted spending for social welfare programs. But investors are worried that the measure could make Brazil's debt more unsustainable and affect its fiscal credibility. Congress has suspended the government's spending cap to allow Lula da Silva to raise spending by an extra $28 billion on social welfare and public works this year. The approval is a political victory for Lula, who started his third term in January. But markets have tanked after the budget was passed. The nation's finance minister announced a plan to more than halve the government's deficit this year in an attempt to allay investor concerns. Meanwhile, Brazil's central bank plans to keep interest rates at a six-year high for a longer-than-expected period and has warned of fiscal risks under Lula. De Silva says the current inflation target slows economic growth, and he's threatened the central bank's independence. The chief of the central bank insists the institution plans to act independently, adding that its autonomy gives it the capacity to stabilize markets. From Malaga in Spain, I'm joined now by Mariano Machado. He is a principal analyst of the Americas at Global Risk Verisk Maplecroft. Thank you for joining the program. Why are the government and the central bank in Brazil at loggerheads when it comes to Brazil's economy?
Thank you for having us today. And that is actually the million-dollar question. As it happened with other countries in the world, monetary authorities' decisions, this is the central banks and government's decisions in regards to spending, have created tensions all across the world. And Brazil has been no exception to this. Just recently, the row between the central bank president, Campos Neto, and president of the country, Lula da Silva, has reached new heights. But despite technical discussions around interest rate and measures to tame inflation, there's also seems to be a political background to it. We tend to believe that this is because Campos Neto, the central bank president, has been nominated by the previous administration, the Jair Bolsonaro administration. And there is reason to believe that there is a degree of mistrust between the both of them. So basically, we expect these tensions to last a bit longer.
Lula has actually threatened the autonomy of the central bank, hasn't he? I mean, how far would he go with that? And how important is it to Brazil that the central bank remain independent?
That's an excellent question. And actually, we're seeing Lula barking, if you will, a lot. But the ability to bite, it's the real question here. So in terms of the independence of the central bank, in general, data from the World Bank and other research sources show that an independent central bank is actually an extremely useful asset in terms of reining inflation and providing monetary and policy certainty ahead. In the case of Brazil, this independence in particular was passed just recently in 2021, a couple of years ago. And at that point, Campos Neto was nominated. At this point, we believe that the next stage of this potential escalation between the two actors could be the upcoming nominations for some members of the directorate of the central bank in Brazil. Depending on who Lula is able to nominate to those places, we will understand how this relationship might go forward. But all in all, one thing's for certain, Campos Neto can only be removed by Congress, and Congress has choose for independence. So it will be a tough battle for Lula to handle.
Yeah, it's interesting because the last time Lula was in power, he didn't even have the central bank to deal with. So he's used some strong words when he's come to the central bank. He says there's no justification for the interest rate being at the current rate of 13.75. He says it's shameful and that there should be other tools used to fight inflation. Do you think he's justified in those comments?
I think that Lula has a top concern, and that top concern is basically keeping the economy warm. You cannot govern with an economy that is cooling off, and basically that could be the situation in Brazil, showing some of the highest interest rate, net interest rates in the world, perhaps. But in the end, the true question is if the potential other ways to rein in inflation are at some degree useful for Lula as well. Just to recap, you can think about a new fiscal plan to be presented to investors and to society. That is expected to happen in a couple of months. That was the announcement on behalf of the government. But Lula knows that he cannot rule, he cannot govern on an empty wallet. So we still need to see the fine print of that plan. And thirdly, if you can think of something that is also useful in terms of reining inflation beyond interest rates, could be a much expected, long-awaited tax reform. But that pending homework has been a thorn on the side of every single administration in Brazil for the best part of the last three decades, including Lula's two previous administrations.
And generally, when you look at the markets, investors don't seem to be convinced at all about Lula's plans.
There's not amount of political will that can make 1 + 1 = 3. So basically, yes, there is. We are seeing if you want to call it a crisis of expectations between investors, at least for the moment, local investors in the case of Brazil and the government in terms of what's going to be the policy direction. Recapping on the thing that I just mentioned, when you have a central bank authority that has been nominated as independent and with a tenure that doesn't coincide, the stint doesn't coincide with the presidency, you face this risk. You face the risk of, you can call it cohabitation. We, in simpler terms, it would be having a less strict government in terms of fiscal and spending measures and a perhaps more strict central bank authority. And this is the first time in Brazil in which we are witnessing how policy is being made with these two pillars interacting and counter-interacting with each other.
How much of a concern is Brazil's debt situation, especially in line of Lula's plans when it comes to spending?
Brazil's debt situation has been an issue of concern for a long time now. This is not new to Lula. The latest set of analysis said that by 2025, Brazil's overall external debt to GDP ratio could reach someone along the lines of 108% of GDP. So that's a background concern that has been persistent, and so far no solution has been found. In this particular case, we tend to believe that Lula is focusing on much more on-the-ground type of concerns. This is, again, keeping the economy running to assure that he can deliver what he was elected for. He was voted for happier times, and he needs to make sure he delivers, to a degree, happier times.
Well, part of the reason he delivered happier times previously was because Brazil had that commodity boom in 2002. This time, the circumstances are very different. Given that, do you think he can deliver? Is he aware of the challenges that he is facing?
Indeed, it's a completely different setting for Lula 3.0, as we call it, completely different from his two previous presidential incarnations. And we're already, if the region serves as an example, we're already seeing other left-leaning governments in the region, such as Argentina, Chile to a degree, even Colombia with Gustavo Petro recently elected last year, struggling exactly with the same dilemma. Right into office with abundant promises of delivering economic prosperity, nonetheless, finding a completely different setting in terms of governance. We're seeing weaker governance with inability to just steamroll their policy priorities. And on the external side, we're seeing a much shakier geopolitical context that doesn't allow for these promises to be bankrolled in the way that they used to be. The inner circle of Lula is very much aware of this. So 1 month and change into his third presidency, we believe that we're still seeing different elements in the coalition accommodating to this new reality. And perhaps that we'll have more clarity on the back end of this year.
Mariano Machado, really good to talk to you. Mariano, principal analyst of the Americas at Global Risk VRisk Maplecroft. Thank you for your time.
A pleasure.
Hong Kong is facing the highest rate of homelessness in a decade. It's one of the most expensive cities to live in, and rising inflation has sent the cost of everything from food to rent soaring. Jessica Washington met some of the people in Hong Kong forced to make the street their home.
This is the image of Hong Kong that dazzles visitors, a bustling, glamorous city. But underground, a different reality appears.
Oh, come on. There are many mosquitoes and bed bugs here. You see so many. I'm getting fungal infections.
He has slept here for 4 years and looks through rubbish bins for leftover food in takeaway boxes. Official figures released in November show the number of people experiencing homelessness is the highest in a decade, and there's a sharp rise in the number of women experiencing housing insecurity. That report also said there's a need for better services and more funds for hostel accommodation as the situation worsens.
This is a very wealthy city. You know, it's extremely wealthy, but one in five at this moment are having food insecurity. They cannot afford three meals a day. You know, it's an amazing city where you see the haves and the have-nots, and it's in your face all the time.
Impact HK is an NGO founded in 2017. So far, they've helped around 500 people find shelter. They also welcome people into their community centres for hot meals and fresh clothes.
Over 90% of those individuals have no emergency contacts. They have no friend or family member in their life. And that isolation, you know, plays a huge role in their, you know, step towards becoming homeless.
He says emergency shelters provided by the government don't address the needs of the city and are difficult for people to access. The Hong Kong government told Al Jazeera social workers give assistance to those willing to accept services. In Tai Kok Choi, there are more than 30 people sharing this underground space.
It's the middle of winter.
winter here in Hong Kong and the temperature often drops below 10 degrees at night. The people in this underpass are preparing for another night exposed to freezing conditions. Alec used to be one of them. He spent almost 20 years on the streets.
Now I have a place to live. I have food to eat and a job. I'm happy and more cheerful now.
Now he works in the community center, distributing food and essentials to people sleeping outside, helping them through the same dark days he experienced during his time on the streets.
And that is our show for this week. Get in touch with us by tweeting me at Marlene Saeed, and do use the hashtag AJCTC when you do, or drop us an email, countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. But there's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That'll take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links and entire episodes for you to catch up on. That is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Marlene Saeed. From the whole team, thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.